Now I want to review with you the case management checklist I developed for this exam. A case management checklist is a valuable tool in the assessment of your clinical performance. It not only assures a thorough evaluation, but it's also very helpful in the event that you are in trouble. If a diagnosis isn't materializing, or if a patient isn't responding to normal therapeutic measures, this can be a lifesaver, literally. The checklist I have prepared is a long one, but it is divided into 6 segments for easier learning. I recommend that you learn 1 segment at a time. I also recommend that you use this checklist in the emergency department as you are writing up a patient's chart. This is an ideal risk management tool, and repeated use will make it habitual for you so that it will be there with you in the exam. If you are listening to this CD while sitting in a room, I recommend that you take a pencil and paper and write down key words and phrases as you listen. This will facilitate the learning process. If you are driving your car, listen to 1 segment at a time, turning off the CD and mentally reviewing what you have heard before proceeding to the next segment. Repetition will reinforce the message. Now let's begin with the first segment of the checklist, which is the history. The first rule of good case management is this: make sure you obtain an adequate history. Number 1. Define the present illness or injury, including events leading up to the illness or injury. Number 2. What was the patient's condition before the present illness or injury? B.J. Brown, the paraplegic in case study number 7 in the text, is a case in point. Ascertaining her neurologic status before her injury was necessary to determine any new neurodeficits. Number 3. Have there been any recent illnesses or injuries? Number 4. Listen carefully to the patient. Is he apathetic or depressed? Does he have a history of mental illness or an emotional disorder? The examiner may present a patient with a flat affect. Some candidates are so intent on the specifics of the case that they don't pick this up. And do not rely on the patient who denies a history of mental illness if you suspect otherwise. Number 5. What medications is he taking? Have there been any recent changes in dosages or medications? Number 6. Does he have any allergies? Number 7. Talk to family members, friends, EMTs, any significant others if the patient gives a poor history or is unwilling or unable to give a good history. I cannot stress too much the importance of this point. In one of the cases I use in tutorials, a 5-year-old boy is brought to the hospital by his parents and 7-year-old brother. The child is obviously very ill, and the mother doesn't have some of the important information. Guess who does? About half of the physician candidates do not question the 7-year-old brother. Number 8. Decode positive historical findings and formulate a good working differential diagnosis. Number 9. If a history is not coming into focus, ask open-ended questions such as, "How have you been feeling lately? When were you last well? What happened then? What did you do today?" Patients with vague complaints or unusual clinical presentations often don't reveal what you want to know when you ask specific questions. General questions, on the other hand, allow the patient to tell you what he knows about his illness. This is the end of the first segment. The next segment of the checklist is the physical exam, and the second rule of good case management is this: perform a complete physical exam. Number 1. Do a complete physical exam initially on all patients without life-threatening illnesses or injuries, especially those with an apparently obvious diagnosis. The exception to this rule is the multiple encounter situation, in which case you will be managing 3 patients at 1 time. Whenever you are dealing with more than 1 patient, use the case management format previously discussed, performing the H&P in a piecemeal fashion to maximize your efficiency and effectiveness. Number 2. Beware of clinical presentations that appear to be clear-cut. A patient who arrests and is successfully resuscitated may have sustained chest or abdominal injuries secondary to chest compressions. Likewise, an unconscious patient with hypoglycemia may have sustained injuries after losing consciousness. Number 3. For patients with apparent or possible life-threatening illnesses or injuries, do a brief physical exam initially and then go back later and thoroughly examine the patient. Number 4. Initial vital signs are clues to the clinical problem when they are decoded. Always recheck them throughout the case to monitor the effectiveness of your management. If they change unexpectedly, for no apparent reason, look for another cause of the patient's condition. If your patient's vital signs continue to deteriorate in spite of specific treatment, you are expected to try something else, either a different medication or procedure. Accurate interpretation of vital signs is a problem with some candidates. They tend to focus on the blood pressure alone. This should always be correlated with the pulse. Hypotension and tachycardia mean hypovolemia. Hypotension and bradycardia suggest AV block, a poisoning or an overdose with a calcium channel blocker, a beta blocker, or a digitalis preparation. Number 5. Perform a neurologic exam in any patient with a CNS presentation. Determine the level of consciousness, pupil size and reactivity, respiratory pattern, spontaneous motor activity, and deep tendon reflexes. And always check the rectal sphincter tone in major trauma victims. Number 6. Learn the physical exam litanies in the appendix at the back of the book. When you are examining patients at this exam, how you ask the questions can be very important. It can help you obtain all the positive findings in the least amount of time. This is the end of the second segment. The third rule of good case management is this. Order all appropriate diagnostic studies. Number 1. Let the chief complaint dictate some automatic lab work, such as a CBC and urinalysis in patients with abdominal pain, or ABGs, glucose, lights, BUN, and creatinine in patients with an acute behavioral change. Also, in any woman of childbearing age who presents with abdominal pain, a beta-HCG should also be ordered. Number 2. In patients without a life-threatening illness or injury, in whom a complete history and physical exam can be done at one time, order all lab studies at one time. Number 3. In patients with apparent or possible life-threatening illnesses or injuries, order stat test first and other lab later as indicated. Number 4. Order special diagnostic studies such as scans and angiography studies and perform diagnostic procedures such as orthostatic blood pressure measurements and peritoneal lavage as indicated. Some candidates hesitate to order these things because they are not sure that they are clearly indicated. The rule here is, if you're thinking about it, do it. Number 5. Make sure all pertinent diagnostic tests have been ordered, returned, interpreted, and acted upon. Number 6. Before speaking with a consulting or admitting physician, make sure you have the results of all diagnostic tests and procedures. The exception here is the unstable patient who requires emergent specialty consultation. In this case, do not wait for lab results before calling a consulting physician. If he asks about pending lab results, tell him they are pending and discuss how the results will affect your management. This is the end of the third segment. The fourth rule of good case management is this. Carry out appropriate management skills. Number 1. Take time to get your thoughts organized. Occasionally, I see a candidate jump right into a case without actually focusing his attention on those things he should do first. In the trauma patient, failure to immobilize the cervical spine at the beginning of the case is the most frequent error. In the cardiac patient with bradycardia and hypotension, look at a monitor strip, But don't wait for an ECG before giving meds or initiating transcutaneous pacing. Number 2. Always start with the ABCs, airway, breathing, and circulation, in any patient with abnormal vital signs. Number 3. Stabilize seriously ill or injured patients with an IV, O2, pulse oximeter, and monitor, if indicated, as soon as possible. A chest pain patient will require all 4, whereas a patient with abdominal pain may only need an IV. Number 4. Be aggressive with emergency measures when they are indicated. Do not hesitate to put in a chest tube or pacemaker in patients who clearly need them. Decide now under what circumstances you would perform a cricothyroidotomy, and when you are confronted with one of those circumstances, do it. Number 5. Avoid giving any narcotic analgesia, except when indicated, such as the chest pain patient with an MI, until after you have conducted a complete physical assessment. When indicated, however, it should be given in adequate doses. Number 6. Listen carefully to the examiner. He is giving you clues to the patient's problem and expected management. And number 7. Before finalizing case management, order tetanus prophylaxis, IV antibiotics, an NG tube, and Foley catheter in patients who need them. This is the end of the 4th segment. The 5th rule of good case management is this: ensure appropriate disposition of your patient. Number 1. Any patient with a possible life or limb-threatening condition should not be sent home when the diagnosis is in question. Number 2. Any patient who has not been evaluated or one who requires immediate therapy or diagnostic workup should not be permitted to leave the hospital. Number 3. Obtain immediate specialty consultation as indicated. Number 4. Admit all patients who require admission to an attending physician with appropriate in-house consultations and designate special care unit placement as indicated. This is the end of the 5th segment. The 6th and final rule of good case management is this: tend to patient relations. Number 1. Briefly explain to the patient any procedures you need to do and the need for them, using terminology that is appropriate for the patient's age and level of education. And number 2, when wrapping up a case, explain the diagnosis and the plan to the patient and his family and provide reassurance. This completes the case management checklist. Whether you learn this checklist by reading it, listening to it, or both is unimportant. But it is very important that you do learn it, because in my experience with oral board candidates in tutorial sessions, most of the errors made were due to the omission of one or more of these rules.